You're listening to No Plot, Only Lore, a podcast about games and the tables we play them at. Your DMs tonight and every night are Josh and Chris. You can find us on all podcast platforms or check us out at noplotonlylore.com. If you like what you hear today, please rate and review the show and share it with everyone you've ever met. Welcome back, folks, to No Plot, Only Lore, this week brought to you by the O'Parl Homeowners Association. We don't want you here. Please get out. For those of you not in the know, O'Parl is where all of the bad people go in the Bedorn region because they are a bunch of NIMBY suburban pieces of shit. But that's this okay. Their houses fall apart.
This is one of my favorite stupid small towns that we've done so far.
Yeah, there's nothing here in the description other than like these people suck ass. Like it.
In my head, I'm just imagining Greenwood writing this based on like his experience with a gated community in his like neighborhood.
Oh, yeah. 1,000%. This is just some guy with a bone to pick about the guy down the street who said he couldn't put up his, you know, favorite stone, I don't know, thing in the yard. Listen, I run out of thoughts halfway through the sentence.
Okay, so I think the reason that I'm thinking of this is like the description talks about how it's like 60 mansions that nobody's allowed into.
Yeah.
Like you can't hang out. If you're injured, they might give you like some supplies and then send you to, quote, the nearest source of water, which I think is fantastic since it's on the coast.
Yeah, they're just like, here you go, get to the ocean, loser.
Yeah. And then like starts talking about how shitty the places are, and it sounds to me very much like the houses aren't even that nice.
Yeah. Right? It's so strange.
And there's like, there's no market.
Nope.
There's nowhere to buy stuff. You would have to go to like a whole different town to get supplies for your one of 60 mansions. Like what town nearby is going to supply 60 mansions worth of supplies?
Yeah. No, but it is just a shitty suburb for shitty people. Like they've committed to it.
Have you ever lived in a gated community, Josh?
No, I've never lived in a gated community.
Have you ever like hung out in one?
No, I've never been to one. Oh no, that's not okay. That's a lie. I one time delivered a barbecue to one. There you go.
Good. I was invited to a house party at one and very quickly realized that that was not my scene.
Yeah, no
and
shit.
Had more difficulty getting out than I would have liked.
Yeah, once they got you. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's gated from both sides.
That's horrifying. No,
it was at night, and I guess the gate only opens during certain times of the day. And so
what
I had to like, talk to a security guard or some shit to get out.
Why? Why would they do it like that?
I don't know, man. I'm not rich enough to have any idea what's going on in those places.
Clearly.
I live in like a van down by the river. That's
are you saying our niche podcast aimed specifically at four people we already know isn't bringing in the big podcast Joe Rogan dollars?
I didn't want to talk about how I've like been skimming 100% of our profits on live mics, but no, we've made negative money.
Yeah, that's in track with what I thought we were doing.
Yeah, no, I am spending a fair amount of money on keeping this thing alive.
We bleed for you people. You should be.
Yeah. Subscribe and send us money.
One of these days we'll have a Patreon.
I set something up for it and then immediately forgot about it. I think because it runs through PayPal and my PayPal is so old that it went defunct because I didn't use it for so long and I can't be arsed to figure out.
Oh, you can use mine and I definitely won't steal all of it.
I almost believe.
Do I sound convincing?
Not really, no.
Oh.
No, you don't. Let's talk about game mechanics.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Yeah. So, part four of our little mini series, Steal Everything.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to talk about places that you can specifically get ideas for game mechanics in your games.
Okay.
So, like, obviously, if you're playing D&D, D&D already has a bunch of mechanics in it.
Yeah.
But if you're looking to introduce any home rules, you're looking to do anything that's a little outside the box, you're putting together some weird puzzles or, like, some games within games, there are a lot of really cool board games out there that you can steal from to do that.
Yeah, I was going to say puzzles are one great spot, but then I find that some of these mechanics work really well for just, like, helping establish, like, a sense of plot progression sometimes by having, like, a feature or a task that you can reference back to as, like, hey, here's the thing we're trying to do.
Yeah. Well, and, like, sometimes I'll see a game, and, like, this is more prominent in some of the older games where, like, we were still trying to feel out how game mechanics worked together.
Yeah.
But sometimes you would see, like, a completely different set of mechanics for, like, overland travel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Than you would see for, like, exploring the dungeon.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was interesting because, like, it speaks to a desire to differentiate those experiences.
Right.
And game mechanics can be very useful for that, where it's just like, these are, well, and even D&D, I think, is a really good example of that, where, like, we differentiate very strongly between these are the social storytelling parts. Mm-hmm. This is combat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. Well, and, like, combat.
You know, they've tried in the past to, like, smooth some of that difference, like, with, like, the skill check system from, like, 4th edition, where they're like, hey, what if we made it a little more like you're fighting something? And that got very mixed results. I liked it. Other people absolutely hated it. But
actually, even before that, moving from 2nd edition to 3rd, the unification of skills under the D20 was a huge step.
Yeah.
Right? Because, like, we had skills that were being run on percentile dice. Right, like, you had a percentage chance of succeeding at your skills, and then all of your combat stuff was happening on D20s.
Yeah, you tell me. I never played any of that old crap.
Yeah, so, and then 3rd edition, they unified that all under, like, the D20, everything goes up rule.
Right.
Right, because, like, even with D20s, sometimes you would roll a D20 and, like, or sometimes a number going up would be good, sometimes a number going down would be good.
Right.
Right, and so, like, smoothing all of that out for 3rd edition was great. I think the progression that they were making for 4th edition was solid. I feel like the way that we're treating skills in 5th edition is kind of a step backwards, but that's just me, and I'm an old grognard, so.
Yeah, no, I'm old too. I get it.
But yeah, but what's your favorite board game right now, Josh?
Oh, that is an incredible question. Boy, howdy. I mean, like, my all-time favorite hasn't changed, but what I've been playing a lot lately is actually stuff like Ark Nova and Terraforming Mars. Okay. Those are taking up a lot of space in my brain these days.
Nice.
They have a lot of similarities, but that's fine. I'm not one of those people who, like, thinks that every game they play has to be, like, completely novel and unique. I don't mind having, like, phases of iterations on certain mechanisms, you know? So, like,
right.
There's a, I guess you could call it set collection element, to both of them in the card play, where you're trying to, like, sometimes look for same types of cards for combos and stuff like that. I just like that, like, combo-iness of them. And then they both have a small but important, like, spatial component in the map building, where you have to be careful where you're laying your tiles for bonuses or for connectivity and stuff like that. So yeah, those are the two that probably occupy most of my brain power right now, but I'm also a person who plays a brand new game every week, so, you know.
Okay, so not Monopoly.
No, never. Yeah. Never Monopoly.
Have we ranted about Monopoly on the podcast before?
We can do it again. That's fine.
Yeah.
No, I don't think we specifically ranted about Monopoly. I am someone who I appreciate what Monopoly was historically. and what it was trying to do. But Monopoly as an experience has been tainted by popularity and house rules and weird variants. So I think Monopoly works best as its original intent, which was the landlord game and trying to prove a social point to people about the hoarding of property.
Right. I don't think it's a game.
Okay.
I believe that there is one proper way to play Monopoly.
Right.
And because there is only one proper way to play Monopoly, it is not a game, it's a toy.
That's fair.
There's no decision-making involved. There's no choices that have to be made. You buy whatever you land on,
yep,
if you can. If you can't, then it goes to auction. And then you continue to run your way around the board randomly until somebody collects all the money.
Right.
It
is a very low skill expressive game, other than just like, do you know the basics? But yeah, I see where you're going.
Yeah. Like, if the skill ceiling on this game is buy everything you land on, that's the only way to play.
Right.
Like, that there is no better way to play Monopoly than that. You can't play Monopoly better than somebody else.
I have seen the assertion that you should only buy certain clumps of properties first, but the reality is that idea presupposes that you have any control over where you land at all.
Right. And if you buy every spot that you land on, you are going to be owed rent more often. Right. Even if you get a subpar piece,
yeah,
you're going to be owed rent more often.
Yeah.
And that means that you're going to have more money coming into your coffers so that you're able to buy more pieces and have a better chance of picking up the other pieces in a set when they go to auction.
Yeah, owning literally anything is better than owning nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a toy. And, like, there's space for that. Like, there is space for game-like toys, right? So, like, Snakes and Ladders.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't a game, it's a toy.
Yeah.
But it's like a collaborative toy that you play with kids to introduce them to the very fundamentals of gameplay, right? Like, here's how you roll dice, here's how you count spaces, you know, here's the effect that you get for, like, specific squares that you land on, right? Very, very fundamental, but it's,
yeah,
more of a toy than it is a game.
I mean, I think you can safely say any roll and move game is just a toy.
Unless there are branching paths.
Even then. And like, your ability to control whether or not you get to make that choice is non-existent.
Yeah, I mean, it really comes down to the choice and decision-making,
yeah,
aspect of it, right? Like, if you do not have effective choices that can change the outcome of the game...
Yeah.
It's not a game.
I will say someone at Hasbro has heard the complaints and is trying to add on real board game mechanisms to Monopoly in some of their recent publishings. But the problem is they always start with the base of Monopoly and then they weld, right, other things onto it. Which, yeah.
I'm like, you're going to end up with a weird monstrosity any way you do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, we're not here to complain about Monopoly specifically.
We're not? Oh, shit.
Yeah.
no, we're here to talk about game mechanics.
Yeah.
And you have some favorite board games. My favorite board game of all time is probably Settlers of Catan.
Oh, God. Okay. Well, podcast over. Bye, everyone.
Podcast over. Yeah, we're fighting now.
You want to come at me and say that Monopoly is a toy while you're playing Monopoly with some extra steps? Are you kidding me?
There are times that I say things with a straight face and or voice just to see how riled you can get.
I have a hair trigger temper.
Yeah, no, when it comes to board games, I probably shouldn't play. What would my favorite board game be? I don't play a ton of board games.
Yeah.
A lot of the games that I play that are like board game adjacent are card games.
Oh.
And lately I've been playing a lot of like card games and like kids board games. So like I'm not really deep into that sphere anymore.
Right. What? Here we go. Okay. Something just came into the shop this week that I realize now might actually be completely up your alley. So it's something called Alice is Missing. And it's a card-based RPG played entirely via text messages, silently.
Yeah, I was trying to get that in the store when I was working at Warp 1.
Yeah, and we just got it with expansions. With an expansion. Yeah,
I've heard really good things.
Yeah, it's a short 90-minute session. You have to text back and forth in a group chat and individually. Like you're in different places. It has a strong focus on emotional engagement in this mystery. That came in and initially like the instinct at the shop was like, oh, this is a board game. And I was like, no, that is not true. Please don't trick people like that.
There was another one that I saw, I think, what was it called? It was like Free Station or something that had very like board game aesthetics.
Okay.
Like it had a big box that it came in and you opened the box and there were a bunch of chits that you could punch out.
Yeah.
And had like floppy rule books that seemed like they were more board game than anything, but there was no board.
Right.
And there were the cards that you could play with, but it was absolutely a role-playing game. I never actually played it because I couldn't wrap my head around what they wanted me to do with the game.
Yeah.
So like even just reading through it, like one of the biggest turnoffs for me with a new role-playing game is if the lonely fun of flipping through your book is boring.
Oh yeah.
Something has gone terribly fucking wrong.
Yep. I 100% agree with you on that.
So like it did not catch me on that, but the box itself was gorgeous and like all of the pieces in it were great, and if they gave me a board game that was in the same aesthetic, I would probably play that too. Yeah, Arkham Horror. I'm a big fan of Arkham Horror.
Oh yeah. Yeah, Arkham Horror is a good one. Any one of those like board games that has like that, I don't want to call it like strictly a social mechanism, but like anything that has like the potential for that, I think is like right up your alley stuff, especially like Hidden Trader stuff or
yeah, because like for me to play board games, I pretty much have to have some sort of role-playing element
right
to it, I guess. Like I don't have to, but it definitely improves my enjoyment
sure
of it, which I think is why like when we're talking about things like the how to host a murder style games, I am more keyed into that idea than you, I think, will ever be.
Oh, yeah. I've done maybe two of them, and I fucking hated it.
I've loved them every time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't do a lot of them, but every time I've been in one, I have enjoyed the hell out of it. Mostly because it gives me an opportunity to, like, flex the improv
right
skills and also be a giant fucking ham.
And see, okay, I think that right there exposes the problem that I've had with them, because like, yeah, you're right. I could go all out and be the improv guy that I was for many years and et cetera, really inhabit the character. And every one of those I've been to, I will be the only person doing that. And I can't handle that level of like responsibility for the game, for making it enjoyable for everyone else. Like, I don't have that level of, like, I don't want to call it vanity, but, like, you get what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, like, you want the quality to be reflected back to you. You don't want to carry the whole game on your back.
Yeah, and I feel like that's 100% how that goes with at least with the people that I played with the times I did play, you know? Right.
So for me, what I found is that the, like, bigger and hammier I got with it,
yeah,
the bigger and hammier other people got with me.
Yeah, I had the opposite experience, where as I got bigger and hammier, people pulled back and just watched me. I was like, well, oh, I don't want that, thanks.
Yeah, you need better friends. Anyway, we're supposed to be talking about mechanics.
Yeah, murder is a mechanic, duh.
Murder is a mechanic in a lot of games. So, yeah, taking mechanics from board games. I guess the first thing is, like, you and I have slightly different ideas about what a game mechanic is. So why don't we lay those down? What do you think a game mechanic is?
For me, a game mechanic is how I exert my agency on the game. It's the mechanism by which I, move towards victory or whatever the game is trying to have us achieve, right? So it's how I influence my points. That's how I influence the board state. It's how I influence other people at the table. And it's just the levers that I pull to exert myself in the game.
Okay. And because I am the pretentious one, I'm going to bring in a philosophy quote.
Get fucked.
So Suits said that playing a game is the voluntary attempt to overcome unnecessary obstacles.
Sorry, are you saying Suits as in, like, the NBC?
That's a name.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Yeah, that's the guy's name. I can't remember his first name, but yeah, that's his last name.
Dingleberry Suits.
Sure. For me, a game mechanic is any element of a game that serves as either the obstacle or the tools that we use to overcome those obstacles.
Okay.
So, like, oftentimes they can be the same thing. Like, I would say that in a game of something like Magic the Gathering,
right,
the randomness of the cards is both the obstacle and the tool that you are using to overcome that obstacle.
Sure.
Right. You draw the things that you need in a probability sense, right? The randomness, like, yeah, that there will be occasions where, like, all of your best cards are at the bottom of your fucking deck, but that isn't going to be all the time.
Right.
And so the randomness is one of the mechanics that you're dealing with.
Well, and frankly, mitigating that randomness is one of your main mechanics that you're interacting with, you know, exerting your own deck constructing skill, mm-hmm. you know, to influence the probability that you will draw a useful card or even just a yeah. playable card.
All right. So that said, what is your current favorite game mechanic in board games?
In board games, it has to be worker placement. I love worker placement as a mechanism. I have so many worker placement games. I will always try a new variant on worker placement because I...
Right, describe that for us. So, okay. Let's assume that the people that we're talking to have never played a worker placement game.
Okay, so worker placement, in a broad sense, is you've got a bunch of different potential actions in a shared pool on the board, and then you have a finite number of workers that you can place to claim that action. Now, I'm going to say this is, like, typical, but it's definitely not a hard and fast rule, but typically the placement of that worker locks out another person at the table from taking that action. And it's that specific interaction that I find really interesting, because you're playing a game of never getting exactly what you want 100% of the time. So it becomes a much more, tactical game than a strategic game. So you're trying to make the best of, like, suboptimal situations, right? So it's like, oh, I really need to do this turn. Well, someone else is probably going to take that because I can, like, look around the board and see, oh, they also need to do that. So now do I, like, because often one of the things that you can do with your actions is manipulate turn order. So yeah, maybe I take a worse action this turn to give me the turn order advantage to take what I actually want to do next turn, right?
Right.
So it's just about it's a constant optimization battle, and I think that's what's so, like, repeatable and replayable for me is that you're always kind of at war with yourself and getting better and taking the marginal incremental increases in you know, as they come, the little tiny advantages you can stack over and over.
Right. So I guess part of the reason that I gravitated away from that one, so, like, we put together some notes and, like, worker placement was in my list of possibilities.
Yeah.
And I kind of pulled away from that one because I have difficulty seeing how to apply that to role-playing games without zooming out into more of like a tactical lens.
Right. I will say, like, that's exactly what happened in one of my first games I was ever involved in playing, is that we got a little squad of, like, subservient dudes that we could choose a variety of missions for them to go on with various effects. And sometimes it was a matter of, like, well, we need them to do this before, you know, the boss's dudes go and accomplish it, right? But, yeah, like, it definitely... It pulls away from like what would be considered traditional RPG gameplay, and right. and becomes more of a dudes on a map kind of game.
Okay.
So,
because yeah, like I find myself pulling back a bit from that.
Yeah.
And I think it's Jack Black's fault.
Oh.
Did you ever play Brutal Legend?
A little bit.
Yeah. So Brutal Legend starts off as like an action RPG type game.
Right.
Where you're like running around doing battles and like talking to heavy metal stars in Jack Black's weird nightmare universe.
Yeah.
And then about a third of the way through the game, it shifts and becomes a war game.
Right.
And I was really enjoying playing Brutal Legend, the action RPG. Mm. Fucking hated the war game version.
Yeah.
And so I immediately stopped playing it. Well, not immediately. Like, I gave it a shot for like a little bit and I was like, this is boring.
Well, and that was unfair of them, is to change up what the game was that deep into the experience.
Well, and it's the same experience that I had when we were talking about Spore.
Mm.
Right. Where like, the first part of the game is like you having like your own little crew and you're like rolling around trying to like eat other critters or whatever. And then it turns into like a city building, like empire sprawling thing.
Yeah.
And like, I understand what they were going for with that, but the shift in viewpoint is one that I find really difficult to wrap my head around.
Well, and they sold you, like all of the advertising stuff for the game really sold you on that like first 10-20% of the game and kind of didn't mention that the other stuff was there. So it really did feel like a bait and switch. And to some extent, I feel like Brutal Legend did the same thing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there wasn't a lot of discussion about the like war game part of it. It was a lot of like, you get to hang out with Lemmy Kilmeister.
Yeah.
As Jack Black, which is fucking dope, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. But I mean, like, yeah, and there's nothing wrong with like that version of the game. It's just not what you were sold and not what you had been, you know, working on up until that point. I mean, there was a game that came out years before that called Sacrifice, and the whole game was like, yeah, I'm this general and I'm summoning some armies around me, but I'm also running around on the battlefield in real time. And that game super influenced the second half of Brutal Legend there. But that
you need to take a break for a sec.
What's that?
Do you need to take a break for a sec?
Sure.
Just your voice is sounding very like after the coughing.
Yeah, there's something in my throat.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm gonna grab some water.
Yeah.
Okay. Should be feeling better now. Yeah, cool. Clap or what?
Did you pause?
No.
Me either, so. Well, actually, let's clap for like the end of the break. We'll do 3, 2, 1.
So yeah, a game like Sacrifice Super influenced a latter half of Brutal Legend, but you know, you don't want to be sold one thing and then wind up playing another.
Yeah. So I guess like, would there be a way to do effective worker placement, like not even necessarily in like a D&D type scenario, but like across a character sheet?
I guess if you abstract it from, okay, you know what? I'm going to say it this way. Using a standard array is a form of worker placement.
Okay.
You have X number of stats you can put out into Y number of spots, and you have to make, and like placing one there blocks out other options. So you have to just make hard choices about, you know, what you want where.
That portion of the game is over very fast.
I know, but you said character sheet, and I was like, well, that's yeah. A short one.
Well, I was thinking, like, if you had a character sheet that was in flux.
Yeah.
Right, like, your character sheet wasn't set at the beginning of the session. You could move things around across your character sheet in various ways. That could be a very interesting mechanic for a role-playing game.
I suppose.
I don't know what setting would be for that. Yeah, just like, I'm just spitballing here, but like you have a pool of 15 meeples.
Okay.
And you have like 5 stats across those. And when you are successful at a skill or something, you have an opportunity to move one of those from one stat to another.
Okay, wait, I have an idea. There's a variant on worker placement in a game called Architects of the West Kingdom, where you have like a giant pile of workers, but you only place them one at a time. But every time an action is never blocked out by placing something there. So the more often you put something there, the stronger it gets, but you only have a finite number of them. So eventually you'll be out of actions that you can take. What if you start all of your, and I'm what if you start all of your like skills at 0, and every time you use a skill, you get to add a pip to it, like you're training it. So like, yeah, you could do anything you want and be like fairly mediocre at all of them, or you could just like really do the same thing all the time and get a giant bonus to it.
Neat. Okay, we found a way to do it.
Yeah. There you go. Hooray.
Mine is going to be a lot easier because somebody's actually already done it.
Ah, you bitch.
Yeah, right? Simultaneous action.
Oh, okay. Yep.
Right. I really like the idea of everybody in secret choosing what their action is going to be.
Yeah.
And then everybody reveals it at the same time, and then you resolve.
Okay, yeah.
There are a couple of games that I have seen do that. Gloomhaven has done that. Twilight Struggle does something kind of similar. And then the role-playing game that's done it is Mouse Guard, which I've talked about ad nauseum on this podcast already. Fucking rodents, but they're so cute and the game is so good. Their combat system is a rock, paper, scissors, simultaneous action combat system, right? So your team in secret chooses which actions each of the player characters is going to take.
Yeah.
And then the enemy team in secret chooses the actions that the enemy team is going to take. You all reveal at the same time, and some of those actions counteract other actions.
Right.
Right. So like if you're attacking and the person that you are attacking is defending, then your attack does nothing.
Okay.
Right. If you are attacking and the person that you're attacking is attempting to like feint around and be sneaky, you just fucking hit him.
Yeah.
Right. And that creates a really interesting and dynamic combat system where you're like trying to figure out like what is going to be the best move for me to do right now.
Yeah.
Is my opponent going to attack me? If I attack them, am I going to be like opening myself up to attack? Right. All sorts of fun dynamics there.
Yeah. No, that works. No. I'm toying with the idea in my head because there's other games that have a version of simultaneous action selection where it's like there's like five potential actions that everyone's going to take, and then you secretly choose which one you want to take, and then you will get a bonus for taking it, but you still get to take the thing that everyone else took. I'm just trying to figure out how to like work that into an RPG. If it's like, I don't know if it works.
I just had the dumbest idea.
Okay.
Okay. So at the beginning of the session,
yeah,
there are a number of roles equal to the number of players that you have in the game.
Right.
At the beginning of the game, everybody chooses one role.
Okay.
If, like, you get a bonus for the role that you've selected, so, like, whatever it is that you've picked, yeah, you get a bonus to, like, your defense or whatever.
Okay.
If everybody chooses a different role, then you get, like, the Rainbow Friends bonus.
Okay.
Of, like, everybody protected their own niche, but you have to do it in secret and you can't communicate about which roles you're taking.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's, it's got such potential to be abused.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. You would have to do, like, you can't choose the same role every time that we play, and, like, it's only for one shots or something. Anyway. Yeah.
We'll figure it out.
For some reason, I thought that would be great for, like, a magical girls role-playing game with, like, transformation sequences and shit.
Oh, sure.
Right, so you accidentally have two Sailor Marses.
That idea alone is the funniest thing I've ever heard.
Right? I feel like there's a lot of potential for just like not just getting that like Rainbow Friends like bonus at the end, but also for like when you have two people of the same role and like the consequences of that.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. There's fun to be had there.
That's so funny.
We have drafting on here three times because I don't understand how categories work.
Yeah, I saw it. I was like, oh yeah, drafting. I guess that's definitely a thing that could work. Because, I mean, any RPG system that uses, like, any card elements or something could easily incorporate drafting. And then you just started listing other types of drafting that use the same mechanism.
It's kind of the same mechanism. It's not exactly the same.
It's very the same.
It's kind of the same. I guess, like, in my head, it was a difference between, like, an open draft versus a secret draft.
I see.
So, like, I had drafting as, like, the main category, and that was mostly, like, secret draft, putting your character together. And right. This is something that I saw Earthborn Rangers apparently does. I haven't had a chance to play Earthborn Rangers yet, but I want to.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the game, you draft your character.
Right.
Right. Everybody's passing around cards that you take to be some aspect of your character, and then you place those down in front of you, and that's the character that you're going to play.
Right.
And I think that is dope to death. Like, that is one of my favorite ideas for a role-playing game, and this isn't even a fucking role-playing game.
Yeah.
That I've seen in a very long time. Implementing it would be difficult.
To say the least.
I have this, like, I have an idea in my head for a role-playing game mechanic.
Okay.
Where your character is a deck of cards.
No, didn't the Thornwatch game try something like that?
I don't know. I didn't play the Thornwatch game because they changed the focus from the kids and I didn't care after that.
Yeah, fair. Nobody cares about the adults. No, I'm pretty sure that is what they did in the Thornwatch game or something like it. It's that, and I think, I haven't played it, but I think Gloomhaven uses something similar.
Yeah.
Where you can accumulate wounds in your deck that become like a problem in your hand.
Yeah, and like, I was thinking that it could be like, as you gain skills or abilities, you could start like pulling from a communal pool of deck, yeah, like pool of cards, to add to your character over time as like a way to signify.
I'm stupid.
Character development.
A game I own does this. Tainted Grail.
Oh, okay.
Tainted Grail is set in Arturian legend, a warped dark carnival of Arturian legend. But yeah, one of the improvement mechanisms is you have like a combat deck and a social deck, and you will recruit new cards to those decks out of a common pool of abilities. Sometimes you will get one specific to your class. Other ones are just general for the whole table.
Right.
But yeah.
So just take that and turn it into a whole-ass role-playing game.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be fair, I feel, despite its board game trappings, that the Tainted Grail is basically a role-playing game. It's
okay, I'm going to have to look into this and then be very mad at them for a parallel design.
Okay, that's fine.
Which is like my least favorite thing as a person who likes to come up with like cool stuff to do, is when somebody came up with the cool thing that I want to do before I did, and then did it better than I was going to.
They did it very well.
Oh no!
Yeah, it was very popular. It's got this big, thick, like choose your own adventure kind of book that you go along through parts of it with, but it's got like a fully explorable world and all sorts of stuff. But I mean, we have tried 3 times to get a campaign going with some people I know, and it always failed by like the 3rd session. So
why?
I don't really want to get into it, but
is it the game's fault or is it the player's fault?
It's not the game's fault.
Sweet. Understood. okay. So like the other types of drafting that I was looking at. So action drafting.
Yeah.
Is everybody has a pool of actions that they can take, and those are open, so everybody is able to see what those are, and then you go in whatever order it is that has been established for the game to pick your action.
Okay.
So like open draft versus secret draft, I think, is kind of what I was going for.
Sure.
With that. And then the dice drafting, in my head, dice drafting isn't just dice drafting, right? It isn't just drafting. It's also set collection. Like, it's a weird hybrid of the two.
It's nice that you think that, but...
Am I just dumb? I could just be dumb.
I mean, I'm not saying you're dumb. I'm saying that dice drafting... Like, if you're saying somehow that the idea of set collection is unique to the dice drafting mechanism, you're in for a bad time. It's...
No, I'm not sure that I've ever seen dice drafting separated from set collection, I guess.
Okay.
Right, because you're trying to collect specific values or specific colors for whatever it is that you're doing. And then that is going to be how you determine what the rest of the game is going to do.
Like, are you just thinking about Sagrada?
Shut up.
Okay. Because I was
that's definitely like.
Go ahead.
That's definitely the dice drafting game that I have played the most.
Yeah, because I'm thinking like obviously I've played Sagrada a lot, but the Quarriors has a lot of. I mean, it's fundamentally dice drafting. I think it's I don't know. That was a tough one because it's like drafting, but it's also kind of more like bag crafting, like in the way that like deck building is a thing. This is like bag building,
right?
I mean, if your only example is Sagrada, then yeah, you're correct. That's how the game works. But...
okay, it's not. I don't play a lot of board games, John. All right, what else we got? We got action points. So action points are a thing that exist in D&D.
Yeah.
And I don't like the way that they exist in D&D.
That's fine. I don't think they exist in a particularly good way in D&D.
No. In Dungeons and Dragons, you have the option of like spending one of these action points to roll a d6 to add to a thing.
But not a d20 roll. Not all classes get to do that, so.
I think as an optional rule they can.
Oh, can they?
Yeah.
I thought we're. So, well, I guess, okay, there's. It could, like, does sorcery points count? Like, is that action points?
Sorcery points would be like a class specific action point. I'm thinking the hero points that exist in like one of the optional rules.
Yeah, never touch those ever.
I like them for like making big weird cinematic choices, and then I will usually also hijack that system to pay for other things.
Okay.
So like in the game that I'm in now, we are using the hero points for the add a 1d6, but we also had a rule where you could cash in a hero point for like to just trigger a rule called I know a guy.
Right. I know that one.
Yeah. And so like, yeah, I'll use those hero points, not just for the 1d6, but like I'll find other things that I want to pay for with them.
Sure.
So it's useful, but it's not my favorite way to do them. My favorite way to do them actually comes from a game called Here to Slay.
Oh, yes, I'm familiar.
Yeah, so in Here to Slay, your action points, you get 3 of them per turn, and then those 3 points can be used to do different things.
Right.
Right, and I guess in a way that's... would you consider that worker placement?
No.
Okay, what would that be instead?
It is just the action point. Like, the action points are a mechanism, like, on their own.
Oh, okay.
Often they come with, like, you'll have, like, a much larger pool of action points, but then specific actions cost certain amounts of points, right? So then that's where the decision space comes in. It's like, well, I can do a bunch of shitty actions or, like, a couple of good ones, things like that. So I would say... actually, there's a game that's kind of got a combination of the two. It's called A Feast for Odin, and you've got workers to place, but the strength of the action that you place is dependent on the number of workers. And right. Some actions can only be taken with certain numbers of workers. So there's that.
Because what I like about that idea is that it feels, and like obviously there's other math involved that you would need to sort out, but it feels like a clean answer to action economy.
Yeah.
Right? Like if you have a certain number of points for things that you can do over the course of your turn, however you want to put those together.
Yeah.
Then we don't have the thing where like one character has a whole bunch of things that they can do on their turn and one character has the one thing that they do. Right, because like looking at the difference between a mid-level rogue and a mid-level fighter in D&D, fighter hit stuff 2-time.
Yep. Speaking as a guy newly playing a fighter, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, fighter hit stuff 2-time. Hit good.
Yeah. Oh, hit strong.
Not as strong as rogue on like 3 bonus actions or whatever.
No, I brewed together a new fighter from the new 2024 handbook, and yeah, I can do stuff. That's cool, but not a lot of it.
Yeah,
never too much.
And like, I don't think action points are going to be a thing that is ever introduced into Dungeons and Dragons, but I can definitely see like homebrewing some of that stuff.
Oh yeah,
just like have a number of action points like equal to your level or something.
Yeah,
and then you can spend those action points to do stuff, whatever that stuff happens to be, and then like depending on your character class, different things cost different amounts.
Sure, that makes sense, right? To me,
I think that could be the backbone of a pretty good combat. Or not even just combat, like a pretty good role-playing game system in general.
Well, and there's already precedent for it. I mean, in some ways, the sorcerer's sorcery points there do the same thing. Like, you get to choose what your pool consists of, but then spending those points within that pool have variable costs. I mean, it costs more to and I'm just saying these things, I don't know the actual numbers because I don't remember that, but it costs more to cast a spell twice than it does to cast a spell quickly, you know?
Right. What's a rondel?
A rondel? Okay. God. This, okay, so I just threw down some words of mechanisms.
That's not a word, I don't think.
It is. A rondel is a word. Specifically, a rondel is basically any circular object or shape. But the way rondels work is that you typically got, let's say, 6 to 8 different actions arranged in a circular formation. And that circle rotates every round, increasing or decreasing priority of certain actions. So whether it's incentivizing ones that haven't been chosen in a while or inflicting additional costs on ones that have been chosen frequently.
That's interesting. Have you taken a look at... Crap, I can't remember the name of the game now. That's a great probably game for not. Game. Yeah. No, it's not. It's not a board game. It's a role-playing game about sailing ships over the tops of trees.
No.
Is that the one that I'm thinking?
No, it isn't. Know.
Okay, I've been reading a weird amount of like indie role-playing games lately, and they're all kind of starting to blur together. Anyway, there is a timer mechanism that I'm remembering from a game that is organized in a circle.
Okay.
And it's just called the clock. And the clock is divided into a number of sections equal to the amount of time that you have to do that thing. So if you've got like 4 months, you just draw a little circle, divide it in four, and then you can like mark off the months as they're going. But it's also how they keep track of timing in initiative order. So like where you are on the clock is how that's going to work. And I wonder if putting a rondel on that, right, changing the priority of different actions and how those actions will play out could be an interesting variation on that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
My apologies to everybody who's written a indie role-playing game in the last 5 years. I forget all of the names and all of your mechanics have blended together into a frappe in my head.
Ah, y'all are basic. Anyways. Sorry, I'm in a feisty mood.
No, that's fine. Should I go for the other one that has a question mark, or should I go for bidding an auction instead?
You can go for the other one that has a question mark. That's fine.
All right. How is a Mancala going to work in a role-playing game?
I don't know. That was me just kind of spitballing again.
Let's start with what is a Mancala.
Okay, Mancala is... how do I explain this? Okay, I can picture it in front of me, and it's called a Mancala because it's based on, like, the game originally that was just called Mancala, I think. The idea is... Okay, if let's say you take a rondel of actions, but instead of, like... pulling back every round and then you get to like kind of reset and choose another spot to go, you have to progress from where you were last time in a circular pattern with actions like lined up in a very specific set order. And if you wanted to, like, so you could just go to the next action in the sequence for free, no problem. If you wanted to do something else though, you would pay a cost of some sort to skip actions in that order and progress on to the next one without the ability to go backwards. So you had to like constantly circle the board.
So the difference between just the rondel in general and Mancala is like how stuck you are to your position in that Mancala?
Basically, yeah. Now, obviously, Mancala is not strictly circular. That's the funny thing about rondels is that they are actually like circular all the time. And the rondel itself rotates to incentivize certain actions, but you can always take whatever action you want. A Mancala, you have a set progression that you have to adhere to and then find ways to skip upcoming sections as opposed to like just choosing where to go.
That sounds to me, and like I might just be misinterpreting the way that this is supposed to work in my head.
Okay.
But that sounds to me like a really fun way to keep track of environmental hazards.
Okay.
Right, like you have your Moncala laid out, and as the environmental hazards change and shift,
yeah,
right, like you've got your bubbling lava that's occasionally gonna like burst up, you've got like a bunch of rocks that are falling, and like those things are going to change in their priority over the course of the next couple of turns. You can just like turn that Moncala as you're going, and then wherever your characters are on that, they're stuck there until they move through it.
I see what you're getting at. Yeah, that might work. I'm just trying to visualize. Yeah, I get, yeah. The thing about Moncala is, like, you're right. I'm stuck in this way of thinking about certain mechanisms for, like, how they've been used in board games. And
right.
A lot of them to implement into an RPG are going to have to take thinking outside of the box pretty significantly to...
It's a good thing I don't play board games, so I don't know where the box is.
That's true. If I don't acknowledge the edges of the box, they don't exist.
All right, let's talk about bidding and auctions.
Yeah,
then.
That's
so this.
Yeah, straightforward.
This was huge 15 years ago.
Yeah,
bidding and auction board games were like the thing.
Yeah, I mean, freaking like, Reiner Knizia spent what 5 years doing nothing but making bidding and auction games. Like,
I mean, it was all the same game. So
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I'm just stealing your joke from
before. No, it's it's fine. It's fine. No, see, that's the thing, though. He wouldn't just re-release. He would literally just take the same game, put it out in a different language, and be like, it's a new game! 700 games designed! because, like, we've got a copy of Medici on the shelf right now that I might go pick up. I don't own a ton of auction games, but, yeah, he loved auctions as a self-balancing mechanism for a while, and I get it. Like, it, if you're looking for something that just instantly automatically combines like necessary game balance by like self-adjusting values for resources or what have you, and then also automatically adds in like player interaction in a major way, then yeah, like the auction is kind of perfect for that. You don't have a choice but to interact with other people.
So one of my favorite role-playing games that I think you hate in principle actually works on an auction system.
Which one?
Everyone is John.
Oh, yeah. I hate it already. No, I know that one. I don't hate but like, it.
Taking control of John requires bidding a certain number of the victory points that you need to win the game.
Right.
Right. And so in order to be able to fulfill the purpose that you are trying to push John towards, you have to spend those points, but you also can't spend too many of them or you're not going to win.
Right.
It's also one of my favorites because it's the only inherently competitive role-playing game that I've seen.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that makes sense.
Like, it's the only role-playing game that I have ever actually taken a look at that is, like, competitive and has a win condition.
Yeah. Which, I wish there were more role-playing games like that, frankly. I have a low tolerance for, like, cooperative board game experiences in general, so adding that little bit of, like, hey, fuck you to your game sounds great to me.
That was a mechanic that I was considering adding to the list, which was take this.
I was supposed to take that?
Or take that, yeah. Just like any action that you're taking that directly negatively impacts another player. There are a couple of role-playing games that I can think of that have mechanics like that.
That's so funny.
But they're like some of the like DM-free games, so that you're able to like take people down a peg or whatever. Like I think Fiasco has a mechanic for like negatively impacting other players and like bringing them down a notch.
Oh, this makes me, so I would consider take that like a meta mechanism, where it's like,
yeah,
it's like a side effect of other mechanisms. Obviously games will have,
it's like catch up.
Games will have take that, you know, elements, but one. So there's,
I think
there's
it's on the same tier as like a catch up mechanic, right? Like catch up is just like a catch all for like the mechanics that you would use to like bring yourself up from the back ranks so that playing this game isn't fucking torture when you know that you can't win at the end. Right. Monopoly.
I was going to say though, there's another idea of like a meta mechanism called kingmaking, and I wonder if that would be an interesting mechanism to try to work into your RPG. Where like, so are you familiar with kingmaking?
I am familiar with it in a political context.
So it has the same context in board games, where it's just like, yeah, I know, like the game is down to these two other players essentially, but my actions are going to decide which person that's going to is going to be the victor at the end of the day. And I don't know for certain if that works as a RPG mechanism, but it would, I think it'd be worth exploring the idea that, like, you know, if there are more competitive RPGs like Everyone's John, then maybe there's some sort of incentive or reward for like deciding who the ultimate John is. I don't know how you win the game. I'm just making things up.
I think so. What one interesting thing that you could maybe do with that is hidden win conditions, right? Like, I'm a huge fan of any game that has multiple win conditions, mostly because I almost always suck at the main win condition.
Right.
So like I usually have to try and sidewind it and like take things out from like a weird direction that nobody's expecting. So like if you have multiple win conditions or secret win conditions or individualized win conditions, you can make kingmaking win the game if the person that you chose would win the game.
Okay, hold on. Yes, it just occurred to me that there is a version of this already in a game that actually has a shitload of RPG elements without us ever having mentioned it before, but it's the original Dune the board game. One of the factions is the Bene Gesserit, and the Bene Gesserit have an alternate win condition only for them, where at the start of the game, they predict which faction will win on which turn, and if they are correct, they win the game, period. No one else does.
Huh. I haven't had a chance to play that. I have wanted to. My friend Sarah owns a copy of that game and has been trying to get people to play it, and every single time she's tried to get people to play it, I've been like, I'm fucking down.
Yeah.
And everybody else is like, that sounds boring as hell. What the hell are you doing?
Yeah, no, I have the Gale Force 9 re-release, and I have yet to play it as well for the exact same reasons.
We need to find a bunch of just, like, pretentious nerds to play this game with.
What I need to do is just buy a week of vacation and come out there, and then we will just schedule ahead of time a different group of idiots every day to suffer through these games without telling them that that's the end goal, is to make them suffer.
I think they'll figure it out pretty quick.
They will talk amongst themselves.
Possibly. Depends on how separated the groups of nerds
that's
are.
That's true.
Yeah.
I don't know.
We can isolate them. Yeah. I don't know too many disparate groups. There's a lot of like connectivity.
Yeah, yeah.
The cliques here. All right, and so I think the only mechanic that we have on here that isn't the one that you pointed out was some bullshit was push your luck.
Yeah.
I love this mechanic.
Yeah.
I don't know why I love this mechanic, because like it is inherently stressful.
Oh, definitely.
Maybe that is why I like it.
I think there's an element of like the big win, big loss, kind of all or nothing aspect to it that
mm-hmm.
appeals to you.
It's part of it for sure.
You know what it is? It's inherently dramatic, and so are you.
It fair, fair and true, and also hurtful. No, I think part of it is that I've been playing this game Trash Pandas with my kid. And the amount of like tension and suspension that he feels when he's like rolling one last time, feeling lucky.
Yeah.
And like isn't sure how it's gonna come out. Like it's so hard to capture that feeling in any way that doesn't involve gambling.
Yeah. And that's what this says. This is gambling mechanisms, but you know, for children.
And without like the addiction.
I would not be so fast to say that there's no addiction there. I think some of these kids are gonna get hooked on those.
God, if my kid ever touches a one-armed bandit and wins any amount of money, we're doomed.
Oh yeah, you're toast. Goodbye forever. He's a street person.
It is painful to me how often I have like won at gambling things the first couple of times I've tried. And like I can't turn off the logical part of my brain that's like, you probably should stop now.
No, that's their entire like business model.
No, like everybody else, not everybody else, but like a large number of other people, they play those and they win the first couple of times and they're like, I'm fucking lucky. I'm going to do this forever now. For me, it's like I have won once or twice and I'm like, that is enough.
Oh, okay.
I never have to touch a one-armed bandit ever again for the rest of my life.
I think like, it's because I never win anything that I'm just like,
I win all the goddamn time.
You should stop that. That's frustrating.
It really is. Like the first time I went to Vegas, I was losing money through like a couple of the games. And then I sat down in the airport, played one-armed bandit for like 3 pulls and won $250.
You're like, yay, I'm the best. Off we go.
Yeah. Like so I made a profit in Vegas, which is not the thing you do.
No.
Or like the first time that I played poker in person on like a cruise ship, I won like $600.
Jesus.
Yeah. But then there's that part of my brain that's like, okay, that's enough. You're good. You never have to do that again.
Well, that's nice.
I wish it worked the other way a little bit, where it's just like, cool, keep playing until you lose and you learn a fucking lesson.
Like, no, see, I have that addictive personality that keeps pulling the lever on getting loot from bosses in World of Warcraft every week.
Mm.
You know? Mm-hmm. And then it takes up 10 years of your life as a second job. And you're like, maybe I'll stop.
Maybe that's why I bounce off of World of Warcraft every time.
Yeah, because the loot box doesn't work for you.
I need to understand why. I'm going to talk to my therapist about this.
Good. You should.
Hey, thanks for making it all the way through this episode of No Plot, Only Lore. If you're looking for more, you can always find us at noplotonlylore.com and on all the very best podcast platforms. If you like what you heard today, please share, rate, and review the show to feed my never-ending need for attention and validation.